From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gary Wills, eminent historian and critic, takes a wide view of history. He's applied his sharp pen with celebrated erudition to the founding of the American Republic, to Lincoln at Gettysburg, to the contradictions of the Catholic Church, John Wayne, and the politics of celebrity, and now to the great autobiographer and 19th century historian Henry Adams. In a new book, Wills dusts off Adams' 9-volume mega-history of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and the making of America. It is a history laced with brimming tensions between big and small government, between the foreign entanglements that Jefferson opposed and the muscular idealism that enthralled him. This hour on Point, Gary Wills on the making of America, paradoxes and all, through the eyes of Henry Adams. You can join the conversation. What do you think? If Thomas Jefferson couldn't avoid foreign entanglements, do we have a hope of escaping them today? And what does it mean that Jefferson spoke against government but built a national government? That he spoke against war but sent the Marines into Tripoli? Can you feel the founding tensions still humming in our national conversation about ourselves and the American role in the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Gary Wills. He is one of America's most distinguished historians and critics, professor of history at Northwestern University. He's the author of Confessions of a Conservative, Why I Am a Catholic, A Necessary Evil, A History of American Distrust of Government, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lincoln at Gettysburg. His new book is Henry Adams and the Making of America. Gary Wills, it's wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you very much.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Jack has been an observer and admiring critic of the book and works of Gary Wills for 25 years now, and he's with us. Jack, good to have you.
Well, good to be here. And Gary, great pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, Jack. Long time no see.
Yes, indeed.
Gary Wills, there's so much to get into here. You write a kind of cautionary tale about how we read history, and in a way also about the elements and surprises of that history itself. We want to get into the actual history of Jefferson and Madison and what they thought they would build and what they actually built. But you decide to take us there through Henry Adams. Why this historian? Why have you waded into these 9 volumes to bring them back to light?
Well, I've been in love with those books for many, many years. And when I started to read them, they were out of print. Very much neglected for a lot of reasons we can go into. Luckily, they came back into print in the 80s, and then I've taught them at 3 different universities. They are, I think, the greatest work of history in America. I also think they're the prose masterpiece of the 19th century in nonfiction. I think they're better written than the Education of Henry Adams, less arch, less condescending, much more vigorous and energetic. He had worked on this from the time when in Europe as a young man, he decided he wanted to write some big, great historical epic like Edmund Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And he finally settled on the rise and triumph of the American Empire. Mm. And in his preparation for it, he taught historical method at a time when that was just being systematized. Mm-hmm. He encouraged his students to engage in the new scientific history. He edited the North American Review with special emphasis on historiography and American history especially. He went to Europe and combed the archives for what diplomats were reporting out of Washington in those years. And then he spent an intense decade writing these books. And it was going to be his great work, and it was. And it was received respectfully by the historical profession. They already respected him for his graduate work at Harvard. He instituted the first graduate seminar in history there and graduated the first doctoral students, and for his editing of the North American Review. But they were rather respectful and unenthusiastic about the history because even then they had the kinds of misgivings that grew and grew later on.
About Henry Adams or about his approach to the history?
About his choice of that time.
That is, Jefferson, Madison, their presidencies, the earliest 19th century.
They constantly thought of him as an Adams. which he hated. He said, I've got to be less Adamsy.
The visceral hatred. Grandson and great-grandson of presidents, and yet he said, oh my, set me free from all that, please.
That's right. You know, he thought of it as a great chain. It was not simply that he was an Adams. He was also a Quincy and a Brooks and a Boylston.
Just about every big old blue blood name that Boston could muster, a lot of them.
And he didn't think much of that. The one relative he adored was his grandmother Louisa, John Quincy's wife.
She of the southern air, not
right.
The New England.
She was from Maryland. Her father was from Maryland. And he talked of the quarter taint of southern blood in him as the redeeming one. He admired her so much that he was going to print her private diaries, papers, letters, poems in three volumes. And what those told was a story of oppression by the Adams family. She was convinced the Adams family had destroyed her children and sacrificed her. And Henry agreed, and he was going to publish this. Can you imagine what that would have done to his own father?
Talk about a family eruption. There, a historian prepared even to look into the history and present tense of his own family. Jack, there's such a big mural that Henry Adams paints here and that Gary Wills brings to us, makes fresh and new again. You've read Gary for a long time on many subjects. What do you see going on in this book, Henry Adams and the Making of America?
Well, you know, reading this thought-provoking book, Gary, provoked this thought. Adams's thematic architecture, it seems to me, speaks to the central drama of our time. He lights up the gap between what leaders intend to do with history and history, the petrifaction of what happened. Jefferson is his text, and you'll tell us about it, but George W. Bush could be. You know, in the 2000 campaign, he called for a humbler foreign policy. After 9/11, he had to put that on the shelf. Invading Iraq, he hoped to demonstrate the reach of American power, but the course of things there has demonstrated the limits of American power. Graphically, we spend $400 billion on defense, but can't secure the 10-mile road between the Baghdad airport and the Green Zone. Thus, you know, ironically, American pretensions have been humbled, but not in the way Bush intended, indeed in an opposite way. And it seems to me the moral is the moral of this book. Presidents propose, history disposes.
Gary Wills, it's an irresistible analogy to draw there in form. What do you make of it?
Well, you're on to the right thing, Jack. I say in the book, there's a great affinity between him and Tolstoy.
Henry Adams, that is,
yes,
as he looks on American history.
And the ironies of history that great men think they're doing things. He said they are like the hands on the face of a clock. They think they're driving, and of course it's the machine behind that's driving, and they don't even know that. There are two ways that that can work. It can work tragically, as it's working in Iraq, or it can work benignly, which is what he argues happened with Jefferson. Jefferson kept trying to accomplish something, and Adams is happy that he didn't.
That is, to accomplish the nation that would not exactly be a nation, but a collection of states.
Yeah, to make a minimal government, a withdrawn government. And he said that was the problem in 1800 when he began, that we were minimal and withdrawn and stagnant and intellectually unaggressive. But there were things in Jefferson that made it impossible for him to live down to his own ideals. He was a visionary. He did see a kind of special mission for America, and you can't have that kind of vision and then renounce the means to implement it. So he talks about Jefferson as a comic figure, a bon marché. You have the lightest of touches are necessary because he keeps stumbling into success as present president has stumbled into failure.
So, on the Jeffersonian side, here comes Henry Adams. He looks back. He's been interpreted for many years as having been dismissive toward Jefferson and Madison because they were the anti-Adamses. You read deeper into these nine volumes and say, no, he was celebrating what these presidents achieved, even though it wasn't what they set out to achieve.
Yes, and one of the reasons for that misconception is a great historical scandal. Great historians, Richard Hofstadter and others, have said he deliberately chose a low, mean period so that he could make fun of it. Now, that's reading the Henry Adams of the education back. But what they did is read the first six chapters and never read the last four.
I couldn't believe that. Are you sure?
I
mean, how could an you're talking about great American historians, talking about other historians that don't even read the book?
Right. Noble Cunningham wrote a whole book. You know, he's an eminent Jeffersonian, wrote a whole book on the first six chapters and doesn't even know about the last four chapters. In fact, when there's a forecast of the last four chapters, he says, I don't know why that's there. It doesn't belong there. What Henry Adams was doing in those opening chapters was describing America in 1800. That is the America that was left to Jefferson by John Adams.
The one he disapproved of,
yeah,
that wasn't reaching out.
The heritage of the Federalists. Mm-hmm. And it's true, he does say that this was an America that was stagnant, unambitious, uninterested, incurious. And then you go to the last four volumes, and he said, what a different country this is. It's now progressive. It's interested in science. It's developed national systems. It's expanded to the West. It's making itself felt as a power in the world. And it all came about because of Jefferson and Madison. And, of course, he's telling that story all the way through. But unless you want to see it, you can ignore it a lot of the times, because he is critical of Jefferson and Madison in certain ways, but nowhere near as critical as he was of his own great-grandfather and grandfather. He called John Adams a demagogue. He said that John Quincy Adams was demonic.
Yeah.
At Harvard, when he was teaching American history, he had his prize student, Henry Cabot Lodge, take the Federalist side, and he took the Republican side, and he explained this to the president of the university, saying, I want to use a graduate student. I hope you'll let me do that, because I can't do justice to the Federalists, and Lodge can, and I'm too radical for anything but the Republicans.
Historian Gary Wills is with us this hour. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Do presidents make history, or are they made by the events of history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with historian Gary Wills about the making of America through the eyes of 19th century historian Henry Adams, about how the states became a nation and how we still wrestle with the tension between the two. His new book is Henry Adams and the Making of America. You can join the conversation. If Thomas Jefferson couldn't avoid foreign entanglements, do we have a hope today? And what does it mean that Jefferson talked against government and built a national government? That he talked against war but sent the Marines into Tripoli? What's your question for eminent historian and public thinker Gary Wills? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gary Wills, I wish you'd do us a favor so we've all got the same sheet to read off here, of a little history lesson of that period that Henry Adams was focused on, and how events moved Jefferson and Madison from their opening view of the world and what this country would be to where they ended up. Give us a nutshell history, if you'd be good enough.
Well, events, of course, were guiding them. From the very outset, Jefferson had said he didn't want to have governmental patronage. That was against his country ideology. But on the other hand, he knew that he had to build a national party outside the base of his slave state starting point. He needed to bring in Pennsylvania and New York, and people convinced him, you can't do that unless you replace Federalist office holders, customs inspectors and that kind of thing, with Republicans. So he started a vast scheme of using central authority to build patronage system.
So here we are, 1800, yeah. He's wading in, and the language in his inaugural address sounds, for all the world, like what we hear out of some of the conservative think tanks today, that he wanted to starve government into its proper insignificance. But you're saying to build a political base that spanned these separate entities, he found he did just the opposite.
He had to do that. In order to solve the problem of the 1801 election, in which there was a tie and this couldn't be resolved very well except in the House of Representatives, he had to create a national slate in the 13th Amendment, in which the vice president ran as secondary to the president, which almost of necessity led to national balance. You had to have people from not only different states, but ideally from different regions. Mm. That was nationalizing. Then, of course, he tried to buy Florida as a sectional thing because the South wanted the Floridas very much.
And he was buying Florida from Spain at that point?
No,
he
was
going to France?
He thought that France owned it. Spain right, was right. occupying it, but he thought that France owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to buy it from France.
This is well before Louisiana and
yes.
all the rest.
Well, that's the thing. Napoleon had great designs on Louisiana himself. He had a great scheme of how he was going to build Caribbean power based on Haiti and Louisiana.
And Louisiana was a pretty vast entity in those
yes.
days.
And Toussaint Louverture, the great black leader in Haiti, frustrated him. And in his frustration and in his desperate need for money to invade England, he said, I won't give you Florida, but I'll give you Louisiana at cut rate. So Jefferson had to take that. That
right,
was such a bargain.
Right.
Even though he thought it was unconstitutional to buy it.
Mm.
He thought he had no authority to do it, but he couldn't resist it. You know, he would have been impeached if he had turned this down such a wonderful thing. Then, as you say, the Tripolitan, the Algerine and Tripolitan harassment of our trade
put us on the shores of Tripoli.
Made him send out the frigates.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to mothball the frigates. He never wanted a navy.
I mean, to say the least, as you describe it, he meant to disengage this country, from the world, closing diplomatic missions, leaving commerce to the merchants, putting the navy in storage, just
That's
mothballing
right, right. He always resented the navy because the six frigates had been built by George Washington under the Federalists, and the Republicans had always opposed that. And the frigates were built by a genius, Joshua Humphreys, and they were handled by terrifically competent professional American seamen, of whom Henry Adams becomes extremely proud.
Mm.
Jefferson didn't like that at all, but he had to do something about the harassment over there, so he sent the frigates over. And he didn't know he was creating an officer corps there that would serve brilliantly in the War of 1812.
This was the run-up to even greater kind of entanglements. But already he had the U.S. warships in the bay there, USS Constitution, which Bostonians will know well, delivering those blows, and American officers traipsing across the desert. Suddenly he was very much in the world.
That's right. And then in order to stay out of entanglements, he brought in the embargo. He cut off all trade. He thought, we'll starve the European powers, and they'll have to stop harassing our shipments.
You speak lightly of that, but I think Americans forget just what a radical step that was. What was this embargo exactly and when?
That no trade could go out or come in.
The United States would be a world unto itself.
Just cut itself off. Now, that was Madison's idea, and he didn't think it would last long because he had a very exaggerated idea of the dependence of other parts of the world on American goods. He thought it would not last long, and when he found that he couldn't enforce it, he started doing the most draconian things, sending the army to keep the ships in harbor.
That is because American merchants said, the hell with that, we're trading.
We'd always been great smugglers, and,
right.
and he was determined that that had to stop, and so he started using tremendous presidential powers. He would decree himself who could ship wheat within the borders.
Mm-hmm.
He would kick out officers who would not enforce this rigorously enough. And as Adams points out, again, in order to prevent a centralization of power, which he thought was always going to be the result of war, he centralized power.
Yeah,
he had to exercise some of the most extreme powers a president has ever exercised at all were exercised by Jefferson in enforcing the embargo.
And then with
he
rolls right on toward 1812.
Yeah,
and that
he's
war.
Creating a nation. And then 1812 really does it, because once you do that, you have to start setting up national supply system, national registries, national regulations, how to get food around, how to get clothes around,
how to get
soldiers around.
It's the last thing he wanted. Remind us why it came to pass anyway between Jefferson and Madison.
What, the War of 1812?
Yes.
In order to stop the British from seizing our ships or exacting tribute, there were only two things you could do. Try to make them capitulate by peaceful means, by the embargo, or go to war. And Napoleon was prodding and prodding and prodding us to go to war, using all kinds of Bates and Muirs.
Because he wanted another conflict for the British
right,
to have
exactly.
to deal with.
Right, exactly. He wanted to, the British were blockading the continent, trying to seal him in, and he wanted to distract them and draw them off toward America. And so he would say to Jefferson, in effect, if you'll go to war with Britain, I'll give you Florida. For years and years and years, there's this game in which he puts out Florida, and then when Jefferson tries to grab it, he pulls it back. Adams thinks that the two giants of the era were Jefferson and Napoleon. And one of the great things about his history is that it does see America in an international context, which had not been done up to that point. Mm-hmm. He was the first of the really rigorous people to deal in the archives of four nations when describing a period. And one of the great things about it is this focus on Napoleon. And that's, again, why I was so frustrated. I wanted to prove that he had read Tolstoy because, of course, Napoleon's the great figure in War and Peace,
sure.
too. And it's so frustrating because he did own a three-volume French translation of War and Peace. Well, when he read books, he often marked the margins. So I went and looked. Did he mark the margins?
Not a mark?
No. Now, sometimes he read without marking.
Yeah, yeah.
The pages were cut, but they could have been cut when it was bound. They came with paper covers. But I can't prove that he did. And, of course, he never expressly refers to him, so I just will assume he didn't. But their minds worked in many of the same ways, and especially on Napoleon. They have an extraordinarily similar view of Napoleon.
Clearly that he was, right up there with Jefferson. He was the actor of the hour.
Right. And the same thing was happening to him, of course. He was being thwarted in ways that he did not intend. His reach into the Caribbean backfired on him and caused him all kinds of troubles. So history is playing games with him as he's playing games with the United States of America. And keeping all these balls in the air is what's so fascinating about these books.
And it took nine volumes to do it. Jack, so here we see Henry Adams, like Tolstoy, whether or not he read them, ending up seeing presidents, these American leaders, as like the hands on the face of the clock. And I was struck reading Gary Wills at how this history from so early in the chronicle of the nation is so up to date. At the same time, last week we saw George Bush standing in New Orleans before the cathedral there in Jackson Square, and behind him, of course, the man on horseback, Andrew Jackson. Gary Wills describes through Henry Adams' telling by what a close call, the skin of his teeth, Jackson came to be the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, that the president in the year 2005 chooses to be the backdrop in his time of trial.
That's right. Yeah. He was quite critical of some things about Andrew Jackson. And when he sent an early copy of his manuscript, and actually a bound printed copy, to George Bancroft, the famous historian, he was very critical of his treatment of Andrew Jackson because he thought Andrew Jackson was very undisciplined and disobedient and ruthless toward the Indians and things that Bancroft didn't want to hear because he was an appointee of Jackson and a friend of his.
But he sure made a nice, flashy backdrop of history for George W. Bush last week,
yeah.
Jack.
He certainly did, and of course the irony of the Battle of New Orleans is it happened after the war was over, so it was a pointless slaughter that nevertheless showed the prowess of American, I thought it was American riflery, but you show, Gary, through Adams, that it was really it was grapeshot and cannonading.
Artillery,
yeah.
We had developed artillery to a great perfection.
But a great moment for making American heroes or making their reputations.
Yes. The War of 1812 really accomplished nothing, and some people dismiss it as irrelevant or even disgraceful. Americans were immensely proud of it because it had a terrible beginning, but the professionalism of the Navy and then later on of the Army created a whole generation of heroes. Five later presidents had served with honor in the War of 1812, a whole number of governors, a whole number of other famous people, and the heroes both of sea and land
right.
created a kind of patriotism and militarism that, again, Jefferson was the last thing he wanted.
And there it is, the ripples of that one battle, Jack.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, but ironically, his main descendant, his first descendant, Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party, followed the Jefferson of ideology rather than the Jefferson of experience.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody encountering Jackson immediately deals with the paradox. He seemed to want a strong executive, and yet the executive was being strong by breaking up the instruments of national power. And this infirmity, really what people call the Jeffersonian infirmity in the Democratic Party, went on through the 19th century, where basically the government, Grover Cleveland put it this way. He said the job of the government, the government should not support the people. The people should support the government. that was the idea, and that was sort of the misunderstanding of Jackson, this minimal estate, of Jefferson, this minimal estate, this Jefferson of the Arcadian writings and so on, but not of Jefferson, the president.
And that tension running very much right on through to the present time. Gary Wills is with us. His new book is Henry Adams and the Making of America. A lot of callers want to join us as well. I want to begin to turn to them. Terry is calling from Watertown, New York. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Well, interestingly enough, you guys have elaborated on my point. I was going to comment on the fact that Thomas Jefferson, in fact, as Secretary of Defense, commissioned an armada of ships to be built, and at the time that he became president, he in fact had a naval blockade of the Muslim nations in reference to their harassing our merchant ships. So that point's already been made, and now you've moved on to the War of 1812, which was fought right down the street from where I live, in Sackett's Harbor.
Yeah, of course. It wasn't only in New Orleans. It was in the north as well. I wonder, Terry, do you see an echo of the shores of Tripoli and Jefferson there in Americans in Iraq today?
Well, I absolutely do, and I think that, in my view, that both President Bush as well as Thomas Jefferson are reactionary to the actions of other nations, ironically Muslim nations. And I think that they are not making history so much as just being pushed and shoved around by it.
Terry, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Gary Wills, what do you say?
First of all, let me say Thomas Jefferson was never Secretary of Defense and never built any ships.
You already pointed out he wasn't happy with
never,
that frigate.
And never wanted to.
Population.
The parallel with Jefferson and Tripoli and Bush is fairly lame, it seems to me. Jefferson was going after criminals. He didn't declare war on a nation. The criminals were being backed up by Algiers and Tunisia and Tripoli, but he went after the ships. He didn't declare war. It was a matter of the law of the seas and international law of the seas. We didn't go after criminals. We went after a nation under George Bush. If after 9/11, George Bush had said, we're going to go after terrorists wherever we are. Wherever they are. And in order to do that, we need all of the intelligence resources of the whole world, and we need to recruit the cooperation of every country in the world, which they were anxious, most countries were very anxious to give after 9/11. There was this outpouring of support.
And that would have echoed Jefferson and Tripoli.
Well, going after the criminals would have. George Bush said, we don't need your intelligence, we don't need your help, we don't need your resources, we don't need your advice, and we don't want you to take any account of your objection to our going to war with Iraq, which really is not connected with Muslim terrorism at all, but is a secular despotism. That's quite a different thing from what Jefferson did. And Jefferson was drawn in, it's true, to the Tripolitan action, but he was drawn in reluctantly. And it was not a war of choice, but of necessity in his eyes, and I think rightly so. And when you fight reluctantly, you don't fight unnecessarily and aiming at the wrong targets and trying to overreach. So I don't think that a parallel with the Tripolitan action is justifiable at all.
And yet you point out and warn of how we can pick and choose what lessons we draw from history. A president today can draw a very broad lesson from history and say, Jefferson went, I'll go too.
Yeah. Well, that's sloganeering. That's not history.
Gary Wills is with us this hour. His new book is Henry Adams and the Making of America, a look back through the eyes of a 19th century historian at the very early days of the Republic, how it did not turn out as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison might have imagined. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Do presidents make history, or are they made by the events of history? What are the questions from this time still humming in our conversation? Today, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with historian Gary Wills about the making of America through the eyes of 19th century historian Henry Adams. The new book is Henry Adams and the Making of America, from the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Lincoln at Gettysburg and so many more. You can join the conversation. What's your question for eminent historian and public thinker Gary Wills? And do presidents make history? Is George Bush making history or being made by the events of history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gary Wills, many Americans will know Henry Adams much better from The Education of Henry Adams, the book he wrote much later in his life, which has such a different tone from what you're describing here. I'm sure they didn't use the word at the time, but it's almost snarky, world-weary, skeptical, especially skeptical of American democracy. And yet you say that this book, this series of nine volumes that he wrote in his 40s, is looking back in with a much more positive eye on the early 19th century. As a historian, how do you decide what weight to give which? You kind of discount the later snarky Henry Adams.
Well, the later one is not history, of course, and in fact it's full of errors or deliberate distortions. The later one belongs to English departments, and it's studied for its style and rhetoric. It's a kind of long black joke. He says, I thought I was going to be educated, and I tried and I tried and I failed. I failed as a teacher, I failed as an editor, I failed as an historian, and as a matter of fact, the country is failing and the world is failing. Entropy is going to destroy us all.
So a bitter old man who you feel free to discount?
Well, a cynical and sardonic and satirical man. He had changed a lot. After his wife died and after he finished the history, he was kind of at loose ends. He traveled the world. He became something of a dilettante. He engaged in a long, masochistic, platonic relationship with a married woman, and his whole attitude changed. His family underwent some setbacks economically and in terms of their interrelationships. He had to come and rescue his older brother from economic disaster.
Did he ever kiss and make up with his Boston roots, or did he remain?
No. He said, when he left Harvard, he said, I never want to be back there again. You know, he'd go back for certain visits. But he lived in Washington, in Louise's town, as he thought of it, for the rest of his life. But he spent a lot of time in Paris, where Elizabeth Cameron, the woman he was interested in, lived. And he bought one of the early cars, and he had people chauffeur him around from cathedral to cathedral collecting spires and that kind of thing. So he's very different from the hardworking, optimistic man who was completing a project he'd spent decades on in the history.
An amazing span of life. Let's turn to Jackie, calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I used to enjoy your column so much, Mr. Wills, when I lived in Oak Park, Illinois. I'd like to ask you where the conflicts are today, where are the entangling alliances today that you're concerned about with us, and are the corporations of oil involved in them?
Entangling alliances today, taking Gary Hill, Wills right out of his historian role and throwing him into the fray. What do you say?
Yes. Well, of course. We are simultaneously too entangled with international dependence on the sources of oil, making us prop up disreputable governments, and too disentangled from the kinds of cooperative work at the UN and other agencies that would allow us to escape that kind of dependence. President Clinton had many flaws, many of which I was very aware. I publicly called for his resignation, in fact. But his attitude on foreign policy was that the future is of economic cooperation, not exploitation. He said, we are the only superpower. We're not going to be that forever. At the time when we are, we should engage ourselves fully at the node of every international cooperative activity so that we are invested in it and others are invested in us. He said, I haven't sold that as well as I should, but that's what I'm trying to do. And I hope to do more, of course, but his private life became such a distraction from that he didn't accomplish much of that.
But let me
but
ask
it was,
you, you're
it was the vision that I
that.
Thought, yeah. his, that vision I yeah. thought was the proper one.
But you wrote early on, of course, Confessions of a Conservative, and that applause for those nodes of international cooperation is not what we associate with conservatives broadly today. Yeah. What kind of conservative are you?
Well, I'm not a conservative or a liberal. I've given up on all those on those terms. I think they're comparatively, for one thing, they flip-flopped so much, you know. A liberal in the past was a free trade person. A conservative in the past was static, against change. Prop up the monarchy, prop up the church. Mm. Those are flip-flopped so that they mean almost the exact opposite now. Mm. And I think that they become more swear words than useful analytic terms.
And Jackie, what do you think of the Clintonian view versus Bush and how Gary Wills sees it?
Well, I think this is a very tragic time now. I think it's a dangerous time. There was an article in the Boston Globe recently saying we better listen to what Al-Qaeda demands or what they think. We aren't at all. But Mr. Wills, can we avoid terrorism if we continue to? One war is bad enough in Iraq there, but we've been there twice now and had the sanctions so that so much of that Muslim world resents us and have suffered through us. Can we expect not to have any more terrorism when we relate in such a negative way with these Muslim countries, these Middle East countries?
Mm, Jackie, big tough question, and
yes.
Thanks for it. Gary Wills.
Well, we're never going to escape terrorism entirely, but we've done an awful lot to promote and recruit terrorists in Iraq. It's the great breeding ground. There are the ironies of history are so bleak right now that I shudder even to look at them.
Steve is calling from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. One point I'd like to make is that as a leader of a country or a social movement for that matter, like Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King or any historical figure that we're aware of, they are both creators in a certain way of setting the tone for events that they are reacting to and affecting, but also they are victims, so to speak, in the broad sense, in that they're affected directly by other players.
So do you want to see your president as a victim? Do you extend victimhood status to George Bush, Steve?
No, I would say, well, the thing is how you react to things and how you interpret things creates a lot of how people react to them. As it was said before, you know, Jefferson had all these other factors outside that he didn't affect, but he had to react to them, which, you know, became the Louisiana Purchase and such like.
And in that reaction, history is made, and in that reaction, we judge the man. Steve, thanks for that. Gary Wills, how about it? I mean, you come in, presidents, leaders come in with a certain set of principles or perspective. Events hit them, but it's not foreordained how they react to those events.
No, there's a dialectical interplay. And the Jefferson was not simply pushed. He had to respond and guide. You know, he had to guide the handling of Louisiana once he realized that there was no escaping buying it. He could have bought it and turned over the government of it to local forces, and it probably would have fallen apart and been picked off by Mexico. He realized that he had to change his position and exercise extraordinary presidential power over the governance of those territories. He appointed the governor, he personally, not Congress. He appointed the governor, he appointed the military leader, he appointed the judiciary. It was presidential dictatorship. And the residents there had no say in their future for a long time. To react wisely, you often have to step outside principle, but try to preserve as much of the core of your values as you can. He did try to preserve the democratic ideal in the long term, though he had to use some interim dictatorial measures. A good example of that is Abraham Lincoln. He was pushed around as much by history as anybody, but he guided. He was very good at seeing where he had to give in and where he could stall things and where he could steer things. There's a wonderful book about to appear by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and she shows how between the secessionists and the peace faction of the Democratic Party and the abolitionists and the all of the factions within his Republican Party, he often had to swallow his pride and his preference and go along with certain people to assuage the conflict in other directions. And he was constantly weighing and assessing. And she calls the subtitle of it is The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And it's a study of that interplay between what is forced upon you and what you can make of that. And Adams thought that Jefferson and Madison were pretty good at that.
He liked what they came out with at the end of the day.
They didn't want to do it, but once they had to do it, they did it well.
Jack Beatty, maybe hands on the face of the clock, not the clock itself, but hardly passive players here. I mean, the way presidents respond to what's handed them is more than half the story, it seems to me.
Yes, but sometimes the way they respond can look like passivity, but it's actually leadership. Whereas the effort to master history, to say this is what we're going to do, often subverts leadership. I was surprised at David Donald's biography of Lincoln, that he criticized Lincoln for his passivity. Whereas I really think that if you see him in the Tolstoyan scale, his passivity is a lot like the passivity of General Kutuzov, retreating, waiting, letting the enemy commit himself, and then acting only when he has to, and as it were, accommodating himself to the forces of history. And Lincoln said this again and again, I'm not acting here, I'm being acted on.
It's a subtle business.
Hear, hear.
Yep. David's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you all today?
Very well. What do you think, David?
Well, I was fascinated by this remark earlier from Mr. Wills about the conflict inside of Adams' family between his southern members of his family and his great New England family, and it seems to me that the Civil War will never be over, that we're still living in this conflict. They used to say down south that the South shall rise again, and I think that at least since Nixon's Southern strategy, and certainly since the Reagan Revolution, we've been living in that. You know, the religious fundamentalism, the militarism, the allergy to government as a beneficent force, and I think we're going to come to the end of that. But I'm wondering if Mr. Wills thinks we'll ever get out of this cycle of sort of cultural humiliation and retribution.
Back and forth between the North and South, and we'll put that to Gary Wills. David, thanks for your call. I love you cite Thomas Jefferson's graphic chart of character traits, North and South, and they're wonderful. He says, this is Thomas Jefferson, the North he describes as cool, sober, laborious, persevering, independent, jealous of their own liberties and just to others, but interested, as in self-interested, chicaning, superstitious and hypocritical in their religion. And then he looks at the South, his region, and says, the South is fiery, voluptuary, indolent, unsteady, independent, jealous of their own liberties, trampling on those of others, but then generous, candid, and without attachment or pretension in any religion but that of the heart. Do those puzzle pieces ever fit comfortably together, Gary Wilson?
No, and by the way, Henry Adams had exactly the same view of the South that Jefferson did. And also, he was not so upset by slavery as others are. He was an abolitionist, but he didn't think that the blacks should have the vote. Certainly, people from the very outset said that America is too big to cohere, that it will fall apart. And it's not only a question of the North and the South, but the West. You know, the West is a separate culture and has many of the things that tug against a kind of unity and cohesion. All my family comes from the South. Mm. I was born in Atlanta, and my father's people came from Virginia, and my mother's from Georgia. So I've always had a great fondness for the South, a great understanding of a lot of its pride.
Do we finally meld then, or is it always...
No. There's always push and tug. I like religiosity. I hate fanaticism. There have been fanaticisms of both the North and the South in religion, probably more in the North at the outset. That's one of the things that Adams disliked about New England. He thought they were religious fanatics, and he thought that the South was a more corrupt religion, but a more relaxed, more relaxed and human one. Sure, all of those. America is a hard thing to work. We do have vast differences. And even though there are a lot of homogenizing tendencies in modernity, transportation and communication and culture and fashion and radio and TV and all those things, music, there still is the local tang of Southern and Northern and Western and subdivisions within those. And I should say Midwest also.
And playing out on a national stage all the time. Yeah. We've just got a couple minutes left. Jack Beattie, you've been looking at Henry Adams' Democracy, another angle here. Before we let Gary Wills go, what do you see there?
Well, you know, I was just rereading it the other night, and it occurs to me that the central character there, or one of them, Silas Ratcliffe, this senator, is looked at as a moral monster by the heroine, Madeline Lee, and is exposed as such for what? Well, for accepting campaign contributions, for changing his vote in exchange for campaign contributions. And, of course, he defends that. He says, well, listen, the party had to survive, has to beat the opposition. But what occurred to me is what she's horrified at is, in fact, the norm of our politics.
The echoes that just keep coming. They haunt us. Gary Wills, a final thought on where we stand.
Well, we stand where we always have. Not knowing who we are, but still trying to find out, because it's a worthwhile endeavor and an exciting one. As I say, it's hard to hold America together, and that's partly what makes it such an exciting place.
Well, we are, I guess, reassured to know that it's never been easy. We're right in the flow of history as it's always been. We thank you for the tour. It's wonderful having you with us. Thanks so much.
It's great being here.
Gary Wills, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of the new book, Henry Adams and the Making of America. Jack, thanks very much for being with us, my friend.
Thank you, and thank you, Gary.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.